China hits back with tariffs of their own, stoking fears of a trade war.
The last time there was a trade war was the 1930s, and it not only resulted in the Great Depression, but World War II.
Also on the show, moving forward with Dr. King's legacy 50 years after his murder.
We can't be concerned only about who killed Dr. King, but also about what killed Dr. King. And what killed Dr. King is still alive, and we see it every day.
Plus, you've heard of the chemical changes that happen to teenagers, but what about mothers?
There's really a push-pull that happens when you're having to navigate taking care of this vulnerable creature and taking care of yourself.
And why biologists should study an unlikely place.
The city is actually where the really exciting evolution is taking place at the moment. That's where something new is happening that we should be studying as biologists.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, April 3rd, 2018. Are we at war?
You know, when we're behind on every single country, trade wars aren't so bad. You understand what I mean by that? When we're down by 30 billion, 40 billion, 60 billion, 100 billion, the trade war hurts them, doesn't hurt us.
That was President Donald Trump back in early March, a couple of weeks before announcing he would impose tariffs on steel and aluminum.
We want to build our ships, we want to build our planes, we want to build our military equipment with steel, with aluminum from our country. And now we're finally taking action to correct this long overdue problem.
The president is now expected to announce another round of tariffs on at least $50 billion worth of Chinese-made products this week, reportedly including some tech products like semiconductors. On Monday, China retaliated by announcing tariffs of their own.
128 U.S. goods,
American meat,
fruit, nuts, wine,
pork, fruits and nuts,
and wine,
and steel and aluminum.
Pork and wine.
They're also going to affect about $3 billion of goods.
The market didn't react well at all.
U.S. stocks plummeted after China imposed retaliatory tariffs against the United States.
So we're down 472 points. On the Dow, so we're off those lows, which is close to 700 points, but still a big sell-off today.
A nearly 2% drop on Monday. Clearly, investors are concerned. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, not so much.
I think people are altogether too hysterical. I think that calmness is going to be a much more useful investment tool.
Trade wars aren't so bad.
So is this a full-blown trade war, or is it all just hyperbole?
The last time really was 1930, and that was the worst thing ever in economic history. The United States imposed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, and there's an unmistakable link between the Smoot-Hawley Tariff and the Great Depression.
Brian Dmitrovic is a senior associate with the Laffer Center and professor of economic history at Sam Houston State University.
We had a huge tariff in 1930 and then a huge income tax increase. The United States had never been burdened with taxation like that before, and we went into the Great Depression.
And that troubles so many of us because in a lot of ways, we're just getting out of the Great Recession, and now these tariffs are being imposed. Do you think that there's a risk that it could trigger a slide back for the American economy?
There is a risk, but there is one crucial difference. We just had a big income tax cut. So we haven't had a big income tax increase and then the tariffs. We had an income tax cut and then a tariff increase. So it's kind of equalized. One would think for the economy really to respond positively now out of the Great Recession would need a further net tax cut.
So there are really two types of tariffs, right? Can you explain the two differences?
Well, the Laffer curve means that if you tax a good too much, then it stops coming into the country and it produces no revenue. The other kind of tariff is for revenue. It is so low that it encourages goods to come into the country en masse, and then the government collects a lot of revenue. And that's a very important and much debated aspect of the tariff over the last 200 years. And it's important to note about that first high tariff, it means that there must be other taxes in the country that make up for the loss in revenue. So if you have a tariff that is so punitive that steel or aluminum or whatever imports don't come into the country that had been taxed before, then you have to raise income taxes or sales taxes domestically to make up for that revenue. So very high tariffs actually can encourage other further high taxation in the economy.
So if we could focus back on our American history, how did the politics play into how tariffs were viewed by consumers and how this country was governed at that time?
The tariff was easily the dominant issue in American politics for the 125 years before 1913, and it was brutal. This country hated the tariff, and that's the reason it was so low. If there had been more indifference about the tariff, it wouldn't have been only collecting 3% of GDP. Today, our tax system collects over 20% of our gross output. It was a brutal issue. And it spoke of cronyism and how government is bribed by industry, and that's why it was always pounded down so low every year.
For some of us, this sort of goes over our heads, but just to sort of clarify right now, tariffs were so successful because of a lack of taxation. How did that change when the income tax went into effect in 1913?
The tariff is an external tax, so people have to volunteer to bring their goods across the ocean to pay this tax. It's very cumbersome in that way. The income tax is an internal tax, the IRS. If you make money in this country, we're going to come get it. So to go on a tax strike in the United States in the internal system, you actually have to not make any money and starve yourself. But to not pay the tariff, you simply don't have to take the goods across the Atlantic Ocean. And so the tariff is a tax system that is much more responsive to people quitting it than the income tax system.
So are we in a trade war right now?
Oh, I would hope it's only the very beginnings and they're going to be cut off. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a reasonable estimation. Nobody in the world wants a trade war because global supply chains are so developed that it would really fell a lot of industrial planning that's taken place over the last generation if there were a trade war. The last time there was a trade war was the 1930s, and it not only resulted in the Great Depression, but World War II.
But right now, again, this is just the beginning of this process. For the normal consumers, what should we be thinking about this? How should we be responding?
We should notice if our cars go up by $500 a pop, which apparently is going to be the effect of this steel and aluminum tariffs. And if so, that means that our real income will go down. Our employers will have to pay us more for us to keep those jobs, and we will have higher unemployment. So I think consumers should be very concerned and make it clear in the political process that taxes and perhaps tariffs have to go down.
Now, we just saw the first wave of retaliation tariffs from China. Do you think that there are some products that are so almost holy in the U.S. that if it were touched, it would be a clear sign that we are in a trade war?
I imagine there are some national security products that could be protected by prohibitive tariffs. Outside of that, the pace of innovation in this global economy is so great, it's very difficult to identify a holy product. I mean, the United States produces steel right now without thinking about it. It's so much more productive than it was 30 or 40 years ago. So I actually would find that hard to answer outside of national security, strictly defined.
And what about our farmers? Because they say that they may feel it particularly hard.
Well, if other countries impose tariffs, yeah, our farmers are going to find the bite because America is the breadbasket of the world. So that has historically been one effect of tariffs imposed in one country, is that there's a reverberation effect. Other countries do the same. And then industries that never had to do with the first tariff all of a sudden are hit very hard by the response tariffs.
Thank you very much, Brian Dmitrovic, Senior Associate with the Laffer Center and Professor of Economics at Sam Houston State University.
Thank you.
China's taking aim at 128 U.S. produced goods by imposing a 15 to 25% tariff on all sorts of items, from pork to oranges, apples, and almonds. But one notable agricultural commodity slipped by, for now that is, soybeans. The United States exports about $14 billion in soybeans annually, making China the number one customer for American soybeans. But some predict soybeans could be the next tariff target if the escalation between China and the U.S. continues. Wayne Fredericks is a soybean farmer from Osage, Iowa. He's been farming for more than 44 years. He also serves on the American Soybean Association Board of Directors, and he joins me now. Hey there, Wayne.
How are you doing today?
Doing well. So how many soybeans do we actually export to China annually?
Well, if we look at our total U.S. production, over half of our soybeans go into the export market. That includes China and our other exporting countries. But when it comes down to a simple explanation, about one out of every three rows goes to China. About a third of our total production goes to that country. So it's by and far and large our single largest customer. And that's what makes us awful concerned about these trade wars that potentially are developing here.
You've traveled to China yourself over the years to help develop these trade relationships. Do you believe that tariffs could undermine some of that work?
I'm concerned about it. I really am. I sit there last night looking back a little bit over, our history with China. And, last September, we celebrated 35-year partnership with China in developing that market. And I've had the opportunity to host Chinese buyers on my own farm when they come to visit and look at our soybean harvest. And we've created a tremendous market in that country.
If U.S. soybeans become too expensive, do you think China's going to look, say, to South America or some other area of the world?
Well, South America is primarily the only other area besides the United States, and we'll become by far the residual supplier. And when you're the residual supplier, you're not the one that, gets the best price. And so,
did it happen before?
Well, I farmed long enough to remember what happened when the Jimmy Carter had the grain embargo back in the 70s. Markets were rolling right along and looking good. And at that time, we had a unilateral grain embargo. At that time, Japan was our largest buyer of soybeans, and that country didn't hesitate at all about making investments somewhere else in the world to ensure protection of their supply, and that somewhere else happened to be Brazil. And I'm very aware of the Chinese investment down there in infrastructure currently going on.
Wayne, so there is this theory in warfare that you don't strike with your most powerful weapon first. Do you think that it's possible that China could be holding a possible soybean tariff as that ultimate punishment in this escalating trade conflict with the U.S.?
Very well could be. That's the fear out here in farm country, is they're going to come back. They said they would come back. Yesterday, they come back with the tariffs on, especially on pork, and our friends in the pork industry are seeing that price reaction today, and we're fully aware of that same thing happening on soybeans.
Did you vote for President Donald Trump?
Yes, I did. It was kind of one of them elections that, what's the lesser of two evils in some cases. But yes, we did.
And how are you feeling about your choice now?
Well, I still sit there and you look at what our alternatives might have been. And so it's a crazy way to do business. It's not the way I'm kind of used to doing business. And, maybe long-term down the road, this thing will work out for the betterment of trade for countries. But boy, in the meantime, it's a very painful situation to be going through. And, we've always said, we have the ability to produce and market, and that's the best way to improve the trade balance is to sell them more. And right now, that's not the argument we're having out there.
Wayne Fredericks, an Iowa farmer and member of the American Soybean Association's Board of Directors since 2015. Thank you.
Thank you.
This week marks 50 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. His death came nearly 5 years after he gave his iconic I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington.
I am happy to join.
King was just 34 when he gave that speech, and many of the activists he was inspiring were even younger. Hugh Price was one of them.
I served as a marshal in the March on Washington in 1963. If someone acted up and tried to disrupt things, we were supposed to surround them, hold hands, and call the cops. We weren't trained to engage physically, but we were trained to isolate and then to try to hold that person in place until better trained security arrived.
Price would go on to serve as president and CEO of the National Urban League. He says the March on Washington is what sparked his lifelong devotion to social justice.
That day inspired me to make the anti-poverty movements and civil rights movements my life's work.
1963 is not an end,
but a beginning.
Today, grassroots activism is once again springing up all around the country, and the issues that are compelling people to take action are not all that different from the ones that Dr. King and his contemporaries focused on. To get a sense of what's changed for young activists since 1968 and what's stayed the same, I spoke to Hugh Price alongside Opal Tometi, co-founder of Black Lives Matter.
What's interesting to realize that the civil rights movement, as we know it, was essentially a Southern movement focused on voting rights, integrating lunch counters, etc. That was a movement driven by the church, driven by Martin Luther King, the Southern Leadership Conference, etc. It was kind of a different dynamic north of the Mason-Dixon line, where much of the emphasis was on jobs, on the repair of communities that had been destroyed by urban renewal, police brutality, which of course was faced in the South by demonstrators as well. And actually, Martin Luther King came north to Cicero outside of Chicago to try to deal with racial discrimination in housing, and he did not really get much traction there.
Well, this is a terrible thing. I've been in many demonstrations all across the South, but I can say that I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hostile and as hate-filled as I've seen in Chicago.
We also must remember that the quote-unquote protests in the 60s sort of went over the top and became quite violent and led to the riots that afflicted many cities across the country, and that left a lot of destruction in the wake of the very neighborhoods where the protests were centered. Another thing that's interesting looking back then as well as today is that there are a number of different major movements intersecting around the same time. The anti-Vietnam War movement was definitely percolating. The women's lib movement was percolating. And then, of course, there was the northern movement in cities and the southern movement in around civil rights issues in the South. So it was a turbulent time then, so much so that the FBI had its COINTEL program, and they were infiltrating and wiretapping. My family and I were actually victims of wiretapping.
So they tapped your phone.
They tapped our phone. We could hear the machinery clicking on when we'd pick up our phone, and my wife and I would say, "You're not going to hear anything interesting, so you might as well hang up now." So that was going, disintermediation was going on then, designed to destabilize, to distract, and to discredit.
So Opal, if we could link it back to Martin Luther King, I mean, so we are honoring his life and also remembering the fact that he was assassinated. How were you using the lessons that you learned by studying his life in your current work, leading some of these movements, Black Lives Matter, and also your work with immigration?
So the legacy of Dr. King is multifaceted. And if we are to really examine his life and the trajectory and even the evolution of his politics and his contributions to the civil rights movement, I think we'll see that he increasingly became more and more concerned about those who are more marginalized, those who might be living in different countries around the world, those who might be impacted by war, poverty, and so on. And so I think that our social movements of today are picking up in many ways where our predecessors, you know, left off, and are really building off of the lessons that we learned from that time.
As you look across the eras, there are a number of differences today that have made the contemporary movements even more powerful than those in the past. I mean, the advent of social media and the ability to organize mass protests on what appears to be the spur of the moment. You don't need months of preparation. If you look at the recent March for Our Lives by all the young people who are protesting the gun situation in this country, just the ability to do that, the women's march right after the inauguration, the ability to turn up, you know, hundreds of thousands of people on fairly short notice is extraordinary. The fact that many of these movements are not led by established organizations and high-profile leaders, but are deeply rooted in communities, it's sort of a new phenomenon. The advent of the cell phone. Now with the cell phone, there often is firsthand evidence. The sheer youth of those protesters is a new development. Having kids from middle school, high school, not just college, on the front lines, giving speeches, appealing to legislators, that's a new phenomenon compared to times past, and it potentially is a very powerful one.
So, Opal, what are you experiencing on the street? I know that you work in areas of a lot of intersection with immigration, but also the Black Lives Matter movement.
the reality is that racism isn't new. And the civil rights movements of yesterday and the human rights movements of today share very similar goals, right? I'm really concerned about the creation of this new term and framework of Black identity extremists that the FBI is using in order to criticize our movements, demonize our movements, and really criminalize them, essentially looking at us as though we are terrorists for having the audacity to organize ourselves, the audacity to say being Black is not a crime, and having the audacity to ultimately say that, you know, Black lives matter.
This week obviously marks the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s death. How much progress do you think America has made since he passed away?
Well, I do not want to ever come off as cynical, but we can't be concerned only about who killed Dr. King, but also about what killed Dr. King. And what killed Dr. King is still alive, and we see it every day. You know, we see it's what killed Ayanna Stanley Jones, it's what killed Alton Sterling, and it's what's devastating even Black immigrant communities across the country. And that's white supremacy. And it's not only killing our communities, but it's eroding any progress that we have made towards a more just and inclusive society. And so I do believe that we have a long way to go. And I'm looking to my mentors and elders to show us some of their lessons, to share with us. And I'm looking forward to organizing and working across generations and with more young people to also innovate on our strategies to ensure that we have the type of multiracial democracy that works for all of us.
Hugh, for the young people out there who are listening, who want to get involved, having lived through King's assassination, what advice do you give those young activists?
First, I'd say looking back on the 50th anniversary of King's assassination, I would say that he was an incandescently charismatic leader. Incandescently charismatic leaders are accidents of history. You can't groom them, grow them, or send them to graduate school to become those kinds of leaders. So in their absence, you have to have a strong, sustained ground game, which consists of organizations in communities pressing the agenda, mobilizing, putting together legislative action plans, doing voter registration, voter turnout. That's the hard work of the ground game. In many respects, I think my generation should step aside, stop sucking air out of the leadership arena, stand on the sidelines and cheer. And the younger generation's got to take over. This is their world.
Hugh Price, former president and CEO of the National Urban League. Thank you.
Thank you.
Opal Tometi, executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration and a co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Thank you, Opal.
Thank you.
You remember adolescence, right? Probably pretty awkward. For a lot of us, it was. Our bodies, our minds, everything was changing. And while it has some serious ups and downs, we all know it's a normal life transition. So how about the normal transition to motherhood? We hear a lot about postpartum depression, but what about the other real changes a woman experiences that don't quite fit into that category? According to one doctor, the other changes are not top of mind for much of the medical community. She wants to give those changes a name.
Matrescence. Matrescence sounds just like adolescence, and it's the analogy is really helpful. I borrowed it from anthropology because I became really interested in why didn't we have a term to describe the developmental moment for transitioning into motherhood?
That's reproductive psychiatrist Dr. Alexandra Sachs. She says having vocabulary for this transition can have positive, real-world consequences.
How come we only have words for things like postpartum depression? What about the normal transition? Just like teenagers who go through adolescence, women go through matrescence. And I believe that if we can educate women more about what are the pillars of matrescence and get women talking to each other more, we could maybe even change the way postpartum depression is experienced and talked about in our culture.
We've been bringing you conversations about the healthcare challenges unique to women. And last week, many of you called to tell us that we need better overall postpartum care in America. Dr. Sachs says yes, and understanding this transitional period is one step.
You know, what I've really learned is that it's not just psychiatric. Women don't return for a health visit with their OBGYN until 6 weeks.
6 weeks later.
6 weeks later, right. So when we say, is the postpartum under-examined, I would say yes, and that's physical and emotional. In countries like England, the government pays for a nurse to come visit a woman immediately after the postpartum, certainly within that six-week window, because we know that's the most common time for things to come up in terms of complications, physical and emotional, that are the result of the labor and delivery experience and the enormous physiological and anatomical change that happens during pregnancy.
So often when we think about these changes, we only talk about postpartum depression. But if you could expand my horizons a little bit more and explain to me about some of the other changes that take place during this period.
The body is going through an amazing shift, and there are all these interesting consequences. There hasn't, unfortunately, been enough research, and that's part of what I'm trying to sort of call out. But in the 2017 Nature Neuroscience, there was a wonderful article that was published based on research that was done by scientists in Spain and the Netherlands, where they showed that there are brain changes that we can see in women up to 2 years after delivering a baby. The interpersonal regions actually changed. So those might be regions actually that code for the ability to empathize, to maybe recognize your baby's cry or zoom into their facial cues. So these are interesting questions. How have women even been evolutionarily impacted in terms of brain changes for what to zero in on in terms of the experience of caretaking and zooming in on those interpersonal strengths? And, you know, it's really fascinating. The human baby is really the most vulnerable in all of the animal kingdom, potentially. We know that to be as independent as a baby chimpanzee, a human baby would have to be 18 months old. So women would have to be pregnant for 18 months to be on par with what chimpanzees have in terms of their mother-child care. So it's a really phenomenal relationship between the mother and the baby in terms of this tremendous dependency in the first year of life.
If there are two or three points that you want women to know about matrescence, what would those be?
So one of them is that I would say you're going to be experiencing the emotion of ambivalence.
Ambivalence?
Yes. And ambivalence does not mean that you're ambivalent about how much you love your baby, but you're going to feel ambivalent about the push and pull required for having to take care of your baby constantly and how to navigate figuring out how to take care of yourself. You're going to feel guilty when you have moments where you need to let your baby cry for a minute so that you can actually go to the bathroom or so that you can pick up the telephone. We are humans. We're not robots, and we can't cut off our needs. But when we're put in the position of having to care for this vulnerable creature, it's a feeling of ambivalence that we have when we have to pull away from them to care for ourselves. But it's really that push and pull of leaning in, loving our children, and then stepping back and saying, okay, who am I? What do I need to do for my emotional wellness, my intellectual wellness, my relationships with my friends and partner, my professional identity and goals? How do I lean in and lean out to care for my child and myself in this dance?
So what would it take to change the silence around some of these issues?
I think there's so much stigma and shame around the ups and downs that happen for women that women aren't speaking as openly as they could, which would, I think, really prevent a lot of the isolation and shame that may fuel rates of depression. I hear from women in my office that they come in and they say, I'm the only one in my group of friends who's had a miscarriage. I'm the only one who has not been able to breastfeed. And statistically, that is just simply not accurate. The rates of those experiences are so much higher than I think many women admit to each other socially. But I think we really have polarized the concepts of a perfect mother and bad mother. And so I think women often don't talk about their matrescence stories because really the experience of motherhood is a lot of ups and downs. There's so many things that are normal transitional that sort of get easier after the first year that we really need to educate people about so they can speak more openly and feel more reassured.
So I think some people might hear this and say, okay, all this is well and good to talk about these issues more, but how do we get more funding for actual programs to help women? Is there a way to get insurance providers, hospitals, medical professionals to take notice of this and relieve some of the financial burden of this period in a woman's transition to motherhood?
In general, we need to have more funding for preventative care. And we also need to give doctors more reimbursement for spending time talking to their patients. You know, dosing a medication or doing a procedure can be coded differently and often more highly reimbursed than the time spent talking with our patients. So we really need to shift that model and encourage insurance companies to reimburse doctors for more time spent educating patients about preventative approaches. I also think we need to talk to doctors more about remembering to pay attention to the woman, even in pediatric encounters when we're there to talk about the child, to ask mom, how are you doing? But there still isn't enough service for treatment. We need to have more access to care for psychotherapy and for mental health treatment options that, you know, really need to be viewed as important and as impactful for health as physical conditions.
Dr. Alexandra Sachs, reproductive psychiatrist, New York Times contributor, co-author of the forthcoming book, How Come No One Told Me, The Emotional Guide to Pregnancy and the First Year of Motherhood. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we've been hearing your thoughts about that time in your life.
Hi, my name is Gail Beam. I'm calling from Milton, West Virginia, and my oldest child is 23. You know, my husband and I grappled with these same issues that the psychiatrist was just talking about in terms of in what way do these problems get aired? You know, when the woman goes to her six-week checkup, it's the day she got a shower and looks good. And there's really no forum to have psych issues addressed. And we've grappled with that 23 years ago, and it sounds like people are still grappling with it today.
Hi, this is Emily from St. Louis, Missouri. I loved the story. It was very interesting to me, and I wish someone would have told me that because I had a C-section, it took a few extra weeks to really bond with my child just because my body didn't go into natural labor. I didn't release the same hormones, and I wasn't told that until months later, and it made sense after someone talked to me about it.
It's so great to have a name to this phenomenon that women go through. I have three children, and I now consider myself a pro, but everything I went through on my first child, I had no idea. It would be great to have more conversation about it, especially in the workplace, that allowed us to just be more comfortable with what we go through.
Hi, this is Anna from Seattle. My matrescence was incredibly difficult. I had ambivalence, I had guilt, I had extreme anxiety. I had a lot of health issues after giving birth, and I was really limited in what I was able to do physically. I fell into a pretty dark postpartum anxiety and depression. It didn't hit me in the way that I expected it to. It presented itself as anxiety. The way that I look back at my matrescence, I really love that term, is similar to the way I look back at adolescence, actually. It felt like going through a fire.
Hi, I'm Natalie from Seattle, Washington, and I just listened to the take on matrescence, which I think is a really interesting term that I'm just hearing for the first time, and I think a lot of people are. I'm actually a postpartum doula, so I work with a lot of families after they've had a baby, and I totally agree with her. I think that there should be a lot more concentration on the mother after she has a baby, and a lot of the time there is a lot of medication that's being handed out or things that there's not a lot of listening that's going on, and a lot of the time my job is just to listen. I had really bad postpartum depression, and I might not have gone down that road if someone would have just taken the time to listen to me.
Hi, this is Cataline Lefevre. I'm calling from Richardson, Texas. I had an atypical postpartum experience. I had tons of support around me, a wonderful husband who was there, had time off for about 3 months. But with all that support and all that help, I still felt lost. The nights of not sleeping caught up with me, and after about 6 weeks, I could not sleep. And eventually I did contact my OB-GYN and told him that I thought I did have postpartum depression. And he worked with me to find a medication that would work, and I started to sleep again. It was a very difficult emotional time for me. I felt like I was failing in so many ways. I was failing my baby, I was failing myself, I was failing my husband, but I was able to get through it and have another baby a few years later. But it is an incredibly difficult time for women, and we need to talk about it. We need to share what's going on and not live in the shadows. So many of us go through this. It isn't easy, and we need to be there for each other.
Duarte Geraldino here with you on The Takeaway. When we think of wildlife and natural environments, we think of untouched forests and jungles, pristine waterways, and sprawling hills and countrysides. One place we don't think of is cities. But that type of thinking no longer matches up to our world, according to Menno Schildhausen. He's the author of the new book out today, Darwin Comes to Town: How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Rather than shying away from urban environments, Schildhausen argues, to understand how life really works in this increasingly human-dominated world, biologists need to study what's happening in the overlooked nooks and crannies of our cities.
As biologists, we're always supposed to not to go to the city. We just say there's no biodiversity there. The really interesting things are out there in the forest. But I think when we really look closely, we see that in cities, there's actually very interesting biology going on, a lot of interesting ecology. Because when a lot of people live in the same place as we do in cities, we concentrate a lot of resources there. We bring in a lot of food, we provide structures, we provide all kinds of things that animals and plants can benefit from. Just like, for example, ants' nest. When you dig up an ants' nest, which is basically a small-scale city, you find that there are other insects that are living in those ants' nests. Snails, millipedes, they're all species that have evolved to find a niche in that ant city. More and more biologists are now discovering that the same thing is going on in our cities, that there are wild animals and plants that are evolving to find a niche in that unique new habitat that we've created, namely the city. So once you realize that, you begin to see that the city is actually where the really exciting evolution is taking place at the moment, that that's where something new is happening that we should be studying as biologists.
One of the larger arguments of your book is this notion that nature isn't just outside of the cities, but the city itself is in some way natural, that it's part of the environment.
Yes. Yeah. I think we are used to viewing nature as everything that doesn't involve people. But then we're forgetting that we are also a species that fits in the tree of life, that fits in the evolutionary family tree. And we are a species that has evolved the ability to change its environment drastically, even more drastically than termites or ants or other animals, which we call ecosystem engineers. That's the term that biologists use for a species that is able to change its environment in such a way that it creates niches for other species. So like ants, like termites, like beavers, like corals, they create a place in nature where other species can live, and people do the same thing. So I think what we are doing in creating these cities is natural, except it's very new. It's something that we've only been doing for the last few thousand years, but apparently it's in our genes and it's natural.
So when you talk about humans being sort of ecosystem engineers, because we are in many ways at the top of the food chain and arguably the most powerful species that the planet has ever seen, there's something that you coined the human-induced rapid evolutionary change.
Yes.
What is that?
Yeah. So that's a term that we use. So HIREC, human-induced rapid evolutionary change, which is a phenomenon that we see now, namely that other species evolve very quickly, sometimes in a matter of years, they change genetically in a way that has to do with how we change their environment. An example that I find fascinating is in one of the best known city animals is the city pigeon, which is picking up a lot of pollutants. It's harming them, but they can control this by, at least some pigeons can, the darker ones, the ones that have dark feathers. You may have seen that you have these light gray ones, you have much darker gray ones. The ones with dark feathers, they have melanin in their feathers, and the melanin binds these heavy metals. So you see that in cities, the darker ones have an advantage, and they're reproducing much more efficiently. So in cities, you see that the average hue of the city pigeons is getting darker and darker and darker, because those are the ones that are good at detoxifying their bodies by getting rid of those heavy metals by putting them in their feathers. And that's HIREC. That is human-induced rapid evolutionary change. These pigeons are changing rapidly in the face of this pollution.
So your work is not without controversy. Your critics will say your work is sort of an excuse for us not to care about the environment, because if the city is in fact a part of nature, then whatever we do can't really harm nature. What do you say to your critics who will argue what you are doing is in some ways dangerous?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you can have it both ways, because you can enjoy and appreciate these evolutionary changes that are happening in cities, and at the same time realize that the flip side of all this evolution is extinction. There are a few species that are able to adapt, but there are also lots of species that are not able to adapt and that die out from places where human influence is very strong, like cities. Especially climate change, habitat change, all these changes that we're enforcing on the world, they produce this fast evolution that I've been talking about, but they also produce a lot of extinction of species that cannot evolve and adapt quickly enough to the things we're doing to their environment. So a few species are able to adapt to cities, and that's very interesting. It's something we should study and we should appreciate. But that doesn't mean that we can preserve biodiversity by waiting for it to adapt to a world that is influenced by us. At the same time, we still need to conserve these untouched areas where a lot of species are going to survive, which cannot survive in cities.
Why are your ideas, do you believe, so critical for our deeper understanding and appreciation of nature?
I think it's a number of things. The fact that it happened so close to home, I think, is very important for lay people, but even for scientists. The fact that you can see some fundamental process like evolution in your backyard in real time, and hopefully also by using citizen science methods, you can actually get people to record data which allow us to watch this process happening. I think that makes evolution a much more tangible process, and we realize that it's a very normal and ubiquitous process that's going on all the time everywhere, and it's not something that only takes place over long periods of time and in faraway places like the Galapagos. You can see it in Central Park.
Menno Schildhausen, author of Darwin Comes to Town: How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Earlier this hour, we talked about matrescence, the transition to motherhood that's not just about postpartum depression, and why one doctor says it needs more recognition from the medical community. And we've been hearing your thoughts about that time in your life.
It's so great to have a name to this phenomenon that women go through. I have 3 children, and I now consider myself a pro, but everything I went through on my first child, I had no idea. It would be great to have more conversation about it, especially in the workplace, that allowed us to just be more comfortable with what we go through.
We have more of your stories online and in our podcast today. And make sure to check out all the pieces of our coverage on challenges for women's health and getting care for pain at thetakeaway.org/womenspain. That's our show for today. I'm Duarte Geraldino. You can find me on Twitter at Duarte Geraldino. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.